because we care. We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're back, we're dads on the air.
Welcome back to Dads on the Air, this 7th day of September 2010. It's a lovely bright spring day in Sydney, 21 degrees. Yes, a lovely sunny day. So this is Bill Cable from Mediate Now, and in the studio with me this morning is Ian Purdy from ianpurdy.com.
Yes, good morning, Bill. Good morning, everybody.
And Phil York from Dads in Distress.
Good morning, everyone.
Well, it's been interesting news as we're all in suspended animation waiting for the name of the new Prime Minister to come through. But in the stories this week, there's an interesting one from South Australia where the Ombudsman has found that the domestic violence campaign being run by the South Australian government called Don't Cross the Line has found the Office for Women in particular has been found guilty of unreasonable and wrong administrative action after failing to correct false and misleading information on the campaign website.
That's just a really big lot of words to say they've been telling lies.
They have, and it's something that unfortunately is quite common with government campaigns. The Men's Health Australia spokesman, Greg Andreessen, who's well known to listeners on this program, has said that the figures that have been quoted by the Don't Cross the Line campaign are in fact misleading. In particular, the figures in as far as the attitude of young people go, the research shows that some young people hold unacceptable attitudes to violence against women. For example, 8% of young people agreed with the statement, it's okay for a boy to make a girl have sex if she's flirted with him or let him on, and 11% agreed with the statement, if a guy hits a girl he loves because he's jealous, it shows how much he feels for her. However, many more hold unacceptable attitudes to violence towards men. In this area, it was found that female-to-male violence was not only viewed lightheartedly, it was also seen as virtually acceptable. There were erroneous figures quoted in the website saying that statistics such as 95% of domestic violence involves a male perpetrator and a female victim. Now, this is just plain wrong. The data shows that overall at least one in three victims are male. And for confirmation of that, we always refer people to the one in three website. In an interview on ABC Radio on September 2, the Minister for Women, Gail Gargo, claimed that the campaign is not a contest about who is the biggest victim. And we can only hope, as Men's Health Australia hopes, that this means the campaign will be altered to present a balanced picture of relationship violence. But just to show that this is not an isolated incident, the New South Wales Bureau of Crime Statistics and Research recently found that the New South Wales government had published 8 brackets statistics brackets in need of correction in their domestic and family violence discussion paper. There seems to be a widespread culture within women's departments that downplays or denies existence of male victims of relationship violence and abuse.
Yeah, that's strange, isn't it? You'd think it eventually at some stage they'd have to realise that stance is going to damage their cause. Any attack on credibility goes across the board. You know, if they are shown that they've been using false figures as a basis for a campaign, surely that is going to bring the whole thing down.
Yes, and Michael Woods, adjunct fellow at the University of Western Sydney, said the government has a public duty to present facts honestly and with integrity when releasing information in the public domain, especially about such an important area as relationship violence.
Hear, hear.
Michael Woods says, we fear that the Office for Women may be ill-equipped to continue a role in designing and implementing respectful relationship and domestic violence policy because of their demonstrated bias. And really, this is the point of this, that it's not just violence of men towards women we should be concerned about. It's all violence. Women against men, men against children, women against children. We should have a campaign against any domestic violence and not limit it to just one headline grabbing men against women.
Vilifying men. You know, that's what it's doing. It's vilifying men. I mean, you look at the statistics. We are no worse than women. Why should we bear the brunt of all of this?
Yeah, and there's another article here from Mary Papadakis, posted in Parental Attitudes, a journal called Parental Attitudes, and she's found that modern-day dads are finding it hard to juggle work and parenthood, but the good news is they're largely happy with their lives. fatherhood is a hit with 90% of Australian dads, but even so, 55% still feel burnt out and overwhelmed with their responsibilities. This result from a Galaxy survey of 1,255 fathers of children aged up to 17. Some 79% said they had never regretted having children, but there's a worrying 18% that did regret having their children on some days.
But do they break that down into fathers from broken homes or fathers from intact families? I mean, you know, there should is there any differentiation between fathers who are in a happy family intact situation as opposed to fathers who have gone through family court hell and maybe get to see their kid every second weekend and half the holidays if the mother lets them? I mean, you know, what's the basis of all of this? I mean, are they saying that, fathers who don't get equal shared custody of their children and don't get to see them are 80% happy with the idea they had kids? I mean...
Yeah, I suspect that might change the figures from these overall figures. This was a survey of 1,255 fathers, so it didn't say what the split was between those who are in intact families and those who are not in intact families. But the general finding is that, that these fathers are finding it hard to strike a balance between parenthood and work, and that's where I think society has to change to allow men more more freedom as far as their parenting obligations.
Yes, but let's face it, we're run by corporations, and the corporations want us at the wheel like nice little mice on the treadmill, running happily to make them more money while they give us less and less and less and take more of our time. And our families get, and the mothers are saying exactly the same thing. I mean, we're basically just a corporate culture where profits are our new religion, and it's impacting disastrously on families on every level.
Yeah, the survey found the big causes of tension included disagreements over money, which was the biggest one, 44%, the disciplining of children, 40%, and fights over families and in-laws, which was 39%. The top reason for men upsetting their partners included keeping them awake by snoring, arriving home late when told to be home early, and forgetting a birthday or an anniversary. So there you go. They're the hints for everyone out there. If you want to keep
stop snoring
your partner's happy, try and deal with those couple of issues.
Yes, a clothes peg on the nose, or I don't know what stops you snoring. I think you're supposed to have an operation these days, aren't you?
Either that or a pillow, mate.
A pillow. There must be some drug you can take. Surely one of the drug companies has come up with some snoring cure. Just take a pill, you know. Anyway.
Yeah. Now we've had previously on the show Ken Thompson, who's currently in Europe, and he's cycling around Europe trying to desperately to find his son who was abducted by his wife. His son Andrew is somewhere in Europe, last seen in Frankfurt. And in a recent interview in September, or 1st of September, Ken has said that quite frankly he doesn't care if it takes the rest of his life, just as long as he finds his little boy. He cycled through half a dozen countries in his desperate search to find his missing son. So if people are interested in Ken's story, you can go to his website. I think if you Google Ken Thompson Cycles Europe, you'll come up with Ken's story. He's as I say, has been on this show before when we've interviewed him. The story in brief is that in December 2007, his wife was diagnosed as having a paranoia disorder. She left the family home on January 1st, 2008, and then fled the country with three-year-old Andrew on April 24 because she feared she would lose access to him over the psychiatrist's report. The Australian Federal Police became involved, and they managed to trace Andrew and his mother to Frankfurt, but that's where the trail went cold. And Ken's been doing everything possible through the Australian Federal Police and international agencies to try and find Andrew, and now he's taken this step of cycling, and he's going to keep cycling till he finds Andrew. So
or he dies at the wheel, as it were. So there's a truly tragic story about Ken. It really is.
So let's we can all just hope that he does eventually find Andrew, and that he can get reunited, and there'll be a happy ending. But it's for someone who was thought he had his life sorted out. He's in a beautiful house. He had a his wife and child. Everything seemed to be going fine. He was the Deputy Fire Commissioner of New South Wales Fire Brigades after a distinguished 37-year career as an officer. And all of a sudden, it just came horribly unstuck. He certainly didn't see it coming. And just one other item I might mention is we spoke last week with Warwick Marsh about Father's Day, and while we're on that topic, I hope everyone out there, all the dads, had a very happy Father's Day. But Warwick has pointed to the in a recent article has pointed out the other side of the equation, which is where there is fatherlessness. And we hear these figures quite often, but I think it's something we do need to keep in mind, that 63% of teen suicides come from fatherless homes. That's five times the national average, which is bad enough. 80% of rapists with anger problems come from fatherless homes, which is 14 times the national average. 85% of children with behavioural problems come from fatherless homes, 20 times the national average. And the figures go on. It really is a blight on society that there are so many of these fatherless homes, and you see the consequences going on to the next generation and sometimes even the generation after that. So that's what we're working for, to get the dads back in the families where they belong.
Yeah, there's a couple of things coming out today as well. A video warning young people about the dangers of sexting will be launched today as part of National Child Protection Week. The video, produced as part of the Australian Federal Police's Think You Know campaign, discourages teens from sending inappropriate images from mobile phones because the people involved lose control of the images as soon as they press send. Australian Federal Police Deputy Commissioner Michael Fallon said the online dangers included being groomed by online sex offenders, cyberbullying, being stalked online, and exposure to inappropriate content. Child protection is just one activity the Australian Federal Police will discuss during a three-day conference on high-tech crime being held in Sydney from today. And there's another one. This tonight in the New South Wales Parliament, gay and lesbian couples will be able to adopt children, with legislation expected to scrape through in the New South Wales upper house tonight. The bill is likely to pass by a margin of 3-5 votes. Upper House Greens MP Ian Cohen said new laws would allow same-sex couples who already foster children successfully to take the next step and adopt. So there you go. That's going through Parliament, the upper house, tonight, and presumably tomorrow will be law that gay people can adopt children in New South Wales.
And just further on the suicide interests, Wesley Life Force Suicide Memorial Day will be held on this Friday, which is World Suicide Prevention Day. They invite anyone who has been affected by suicide in their close family or friends to come along and take part in this memorial service. It will be held at the Sydney Opera House, and I'm just trying to look for some times here. At 12 p.m., so midday on Friday, the September 10. If you'd like to receive any more information, if you just go to Wesley Life Force, look them up, and they'll be able to give you any other information you may require.
Thanks, Phil. And I note that Dads in Distress have a new brochure out. It's got some kids on the cover, and the underneath that it's written, "I'm glad someone's looking after my dad," which is a great new approach, I think, from Dads in Distress. You might want to just have a look for that brochure. If you go to the website www.dadsindistress.asn.au, you'll get the website for Dads in Distress. Now, in the program today, we've got some interesting interviews coming up. We'll be starting with Helen Rimmington, who's a Director of Family Wellbeing at the Drummond Street Services, and later on we'll be speaking to well-known author Bettina Arndt. So, in the meantime, we'll go for a short break and we'll be back with our first guest. I say I love you.
So fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child. Dad's in Distress. 1300 853 437.
We're back with Dad's on the Air.
Welcome back to Dad's on the Air, this 7th day of September 2010. And our guest this morning is Helen Rimmington, a Director of Family Wellbeing, a Manager, Education and Training and Group Work at the Drummond Street Services. And the Drummond Street Services has a remarkable history, is one of the longest serving welfare organisations in Victoria. Helen, are you there?
Hello, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. And Helen, as I was saying, the Drummond Street... Well, actually, it is called the Drummond Street Services, I believe, now, isn't it?
That's right. We used to be known as the Citizens Welfare Service, so we've been around for 123 years, and we're a very broad family service agency that's non-profit, and we're not aligned with any religious organisations.
Right, and it started, I believe, with an incident with a seaman, a John Jackman, who was discovered by a constable, had a very unfortunate... a failure to be admitted to a hospital, and that led it to a movement that got this charity organisation moving. Is that the...
That's right, and it was really the beginning of social work as we know it, and so Drummond Street was involved in developing the first social work course. But before that, they were called the Almoners. That's a very old-fashioned name that sometimes we know in relation to hospitals when we go in there and we see the Almoney group selling beautiful baby clothes, etc. So, yeah, we've got really proud beginnings and we're pleased with that.
That's great. And so what services do you offer now?
Well, our main services that we offer are counselling for people who are going through relationship issues. Sometimes they just need a tune-up. Sometimes they're wanting to know how do we deal with separation and divorce and make it okay for the kids. We get a lot of people coming through for that, about 1,600 a year. And we've got family therapists and we run groups and seminars on parenting and particularly parenting teenagers, which seems to be a very popular one. We've got something coming up called Parenting Well After Separation, which is terrific. And people can book in for that. And it's all very low cost. So $35 is the most that you'll pay. We've also got step families courses for people who are reforming their families and their couples courses that are very popular. So there's lots on offer and we do a bit of health promotion as well.
So you do preventative work as well as people who've got themselves into trouble, by the sound of it.
Yep, that's really important to us. So we get out into the community and one of the programs that we've been running is called Backyard Blitz, and that was particularly targeting dads who wanted to spend more time with their kids doing really interesting activities like rock climbing and rafting and high ropes course and things like that. And so we had about 50% dads who were separated and 50% who are still living within their families, and it worked really well.
Yes, I particularly wanted to ask you about the Backyard Blitz program. This is a new program, is it?
Well, we've been running it for about 2 years through funding from the Department of Health and Ageing, and now that's come to an end and we're looking for further funding for it, and I feel really confident we'll get it because it was so popular. And it started with an orientation evening where dads got together, no mums allowed, and we talked to them about nutrition and the importance of physical activity and how to improve your parenting skills and how important it is to have dads involved with their kids. Particularly, we had a lot of dads come and say, well, I've got little daughters, I don't know whether this will be appropriate for us, and that those girls were at the top of the high ropes course touching the roof when we went there. They were leaping out of the raft into the river, we were pulling them back in, and they were winning the family Olympics. And so what we were saying was really need the dads there to encourage sensible risk taking and having a go, because even I was the only woman on the courses and I'd be standing there saying, oh, that's a bit high, be careful now. I couldn't get out of my mummy role. So it was really important to have the dads there going, go for it, you can do it. And the kids just adored it.
Yes, I think that's the different role of mums and dads in the families, isn't
it? Brilliant, yeah.
And I imagine some of these dads really struggled in relating to their children or finding, you know, things to do with them and proper advice to give them. Is that your experience with that?
That's right. And we had a lot of separated dads who said, you've got no idea of the discomfort of not having seen your kids perhaps for 6 or 8 weeks or longer because you've been through a really difficult separation, and then suddenly you're thrown back in with them and everything feels very uncomfortable and self-conscious, and you find yourself saying, look, whatever you want to do will be fine. And then they want to go to McDonald's and play PlayStation. So you do that for a few weeks.
Yes.
And then you realise, no, I've got to get back to doing the things that I know are going to be good for our relationship. So we start cycling and getting into those sorts of more healthier outdoor activities and teaching the dads about what is in their local communities that doesn't cost too much. And we found those relationships then, you know, get back on an even keel.
Yes, I think there's a big tendency for dads in this situation to go out and buy the most expensive toys because, you know, you might be talking about $50 and they're going through a property settlement where they might be dealing with hundreds of thousands of dollars sort of going in and out the door. So it must be a big temptation to try and buy off the kids with something that they can afford.
That's right. And when you get really worried about your kids, you'll do anything to feel like everything is going to be okay.
Yes.
And so I totally understand them doing that. But what we find is, and what we advise anyone, both men and women, to do is the kids desperately want you to act normal. And you might have a whole lot of really difficult emotions inside where you want to tell them what's happened and reassure them, etc. But they don't necessarily want that heavy trip. They want you to act as you always have and be upbeat and positive and say, we've been through a bit of a rough patch, but hey, we're family, we'll stick together, I'll always be there for you. And that seems to make kids relax, and then everyone can get back to being themselves after what is a really difficult period.
Yes, and I imagine the kids still want those boundaries, which the dads might be inclined to forget about. Boundaries, you do whatever you like while you're with me, but it's still important to keep those boundaries in place.
That's right, and I see it also happening with the mums too, because you want your partnership or your marriage to last forever. And when it doesn't, you feel guilty about your kids, even though you might have done everything in your power to keep it together, or that everyone will be much better off now that you're separated. And yet the guilt persists. And actually we see a lot more damage done to kids through this overcompensating, no rules, no boundaries, you can do whatever you want, yeah, than we do through grief and loss. Absolutely. No question about it. So what we say is, got to deal with that guilt, and you've got to keep going with your confident parenting that you used to have. The kids will thrive.
Yes, because I imagine after going through that, you know, you'd tend to sort of withdraw into yourself rather than be looking outwards to your kids and wanting the best for them. You're probably just so focused on the damage that's been done to yourself. Is it hard to get men to come out of themselves and to look outwards in this situation?
Well, I find if they've got good support and they've got family around them and they've got friends who keep them involved and take them out and keep them thinking and keep them contributing and getting out in the community, then they do really well. But when they're really broken for a period of time and they stay home and they often drink a lot and they're quite depressed, then yes, it's very hard for them to look beyond what's happened to them, because often it isn't fair. No way in the world it's fair, but it's happened now and we'll have to go forward and deal with it. Mm. Usually takes, you know, there's no set time, but I'm not surprised to hear that someone's been really in a rut for 2 years and now they're ready to start climbing out of it. That often happens.
And so how long does the Backyard Blitz program run for individual parents?
Well, we run it every second weekend to try and fit in with those people who are on that kind of schedule. So we get together six times, so it runs for about 12 weeks, and it's $60, which is really keeping costs low considering we do such exciting things. And we have a celebration night at the end where mums or sisters or aunties or grandparents come along and we show slides of what the kids have been up to, and people are really surprised about how adventurous they've been, and they even dress up their dads and put makeup on them and all sorts of things, and the dads are blindfolded and we have little games and tricks that we play on the dads, and we have treasure hunts, and look, it's good old-fashioned outdoor fun.
Yeah, it sounds great for everyone. And I think you take a special interest in the eating, so I imagine that some dads might learn how to cook a bit, do they, in this program?
That's right. We start by providing the food, and then by the end of the 12 weeks, the dads are doing it all. And really what we're pushing is we don't want to be too restrictive and say, look, absolutely no junk food. But what we say is that's sometimes food, and these are the things that we can enjoy most of the time. And so there's no lollies, there's no chips, there's no soft drinks during our activity days, but there's beautiful. They love the, whenever we say to the kids, what did you love most about the food? They say, we love the dark chocolate, we love the blueberry. some of them are even into the smoked salmon. You know, we try and get them to just take, you know, have a go is the real theme. And so, I mean, my kids are the same, they won't try anything. And so when you've got the whole group chanting, have a go, you know, and they'll eat their first bit of avocado. Mm. And then we'll say, all right, well, now you can enjoy your barbecue or your pita wraps or whatever we're making, but the food's the main part of it, and they really love it.
Yes, and I suppose having the dads get together, there's also the benefit that they can speak with their peers and they can see what they've been through and perhaps get some help there as well.
That's right, and we've tried to have a real mix in the groups, because we've got some dads who are really struggling, and then we've got dads who are doing well and can be great mentors to other people. So if we find that someone's, which is so common, the child won't do as they're told, they won't put their life jacket on or whatever, then other dads will step in and just encourage and joke them through it and be firm but, you know, have an optimistic view. And that's a really good model then for the father to say, yeah, that's how I could have handled it. And so we help people who are going through that rather than stand back and say, oh, their kid's badly behaved.
Yes, and equally for the children, I'm sure. I mean, they probably start off thinking they're the only one in the world that this has happened to, and all of a sudden they're in with a whole group of other kids and doing interesting things and something to look forward to.
Yeah, 5 minutes after they get there on week one, they're all playing soccer down by the river in Fairfield, and they're loving it. So they're just fully engaged. And this, we have these huge inflatable rafts, so that wins them over straight away. But I must say that, you know, after so long of running this group, and now this funding has come to an end. I've put in 6 applications, and I'm waiting to hear back about who will fund it. But it's just so important. If, you know, it doesn't matter whether people are trying to avoid obesity, or whether they want dads more involved, or whether they want heart disease to drop. You know, there's multiple benefits to this kind of community activity.
So is this funding, does this come through the federal government or the state government?
It did come through the federal government, and now they're telling me, look, there's been a change and we want the state government to handle this now. So I've approached the appropriate people there. But, you know, now's a really hard time to getting money out of state government and federal government too. So we're in a bit of a holding pattern. But, look, we'll always have things on the agenda and we'll take names for people who are interested in this kind of thing.
Great. Well, you've got a state election coming up, haven't you, in Victoria?
Yeah.
So maybe it's not such a bad time to be asking for some special consideration from your poly. So
that's right, and we've done that. So hoping for good news.
So perhaps if people go and talk to their local member and can promote this program.
That's right. Tell them, you know, we want health promotion in our communities. We want fathers to be more involved.
Yes, and we're speaking with Helen Remington from the Drummond Street Services. Helen, just while I mention that, what's the best way of contacting you or Drummond Street Services?
Yes, if you're interested in putting your name down for something like Backyard Blitz, or you would like to do our short but very effective Parenting Well After Separation course or a Step Families course, just ring us on 9639 2576 and ask for Zoe, or you can just Google Drummond Street and you'll find us that way.
Right. Helen, we might just have a short break because there's another issue I want to talk to you about, and that's the 2010 National Gay Dads Conference. So I wonder if we could hear a bit from you about that as well.
Wonderful. Okay.
Okay, we'll have a short break and we'll be back in a moment.
All right.
Tonight, everybody's saying everything is alright. Still, I can't close my eyes. I'm seeing a tunnel at the end of all these lights. Some days, where have you gone? I get the strangest feeling. You belong. Why does it always rain on me? Is it because I lied when I was 17? Why does it always rain on me? Even when the sun is shining, I can't avoid the lightning. I can't stand myself. I'm being held up by invisible men. Still laugh on a shelf when I got my mind on something else. Some days, oh, where have you gone? I get the strangest feeling you belong. Why does it always rain on me? Is it because I lied when I was 17? Why does it always rain on me? Even when the sun is shining, I can't avoid the lightning. Oh, where did the blue sky go? Oh, and why is it raining so cold? So why does it always rain on me? Is it because I lied when I was 17? Why does it always rain on me? Even when the sun is shining, I can't avoid the lightning. Why does it always rain on me? Why does it always? Oh,
Dad's on the Air, the 7th day of September 2010, and we're speaking with Helen Remington, who's the Director of Family Wellbeing at the Drummond Street Services. Now, Helen, I believe you've got a conference coming up in 2010, later this month.
That's right. So what we're doing is listening to our community, and we service all sorts of families at Drummond Street, and so we were doing things like running a lesbian mums program and all sorts of supports for them. And we were contacted by a group of gay dads and they said, let us run a monthly meeting so we can all get together. Well, 30 people turned up. So I thought, oh, this is a growth area. And whether they come to be parents through co-parenting, so they've made an arrangement with someone else to have a baby cooperatively and they're going to share the parenting, or whether they've been through the surrogacy system, so they might have been over to the US or India, or a lot of them are guys who were previously in straight relationships, they're still dads, but now they've got perhaps a male partner, so they find themselves, oh, now I'm in a step family. So things can get really complicated, but what we're saying is, including fostering adoption too, what we need to do is focus on parenting skills and support for these families and the kids turning out to be resilient and happy. Don't concentrate on the journey to being a dad so much because, yes, there's lots of differences between those paths that people take, but, you know, the result is the same.
Yes, yeah, so I would think the focus, I think everyone would agree, the focus has to be on the children, and this is something new that they need to adjust to, I suppose, in our society at the moment. It's still not the not the standard, is it, to have two gay parents in this situation?
No, and I think it really differs between suburbs. So I live in Yarraville, and it's no big deal for someone to have two dads or two mums at the local primary school. Mm. But you go to other areas, and yes, people are saying, well, I don't really know how much to tell my kids to share, and I'm not really sure how they're going to be treated because kids like to be the same. They don't like to be different. So what we suggest is that people actually get involved in the local kinder or the local school and really make an effort to fit into the community. And in that way, people stop caring about your sexuality. They care about the sort of person you are and what you can offer, and then the kids do really well too.
Yes, I can't agree with you more that the kids don't like to be different, do they? They really like to be just one of the gang.
Well, a lot of people really worry about, oh, are my children going to be bullied because they come from a family that's different? But I do say that they can also be different because they're shorter or they're taller or they're fatter or they're thinner or they've got red hair or whatever. So we try and get people away from thinking like that and onto thinking about what will increase their chances of having a happy, healthy, resilient childhood.
Yes, well, it's becoming more relevant because you might be aware in New South Wales it's there's a bill that's gone through the lower house. I think it's going through the upper house today or tonight, which is going to extend gay parenting from fostering right through to adoption. So it's going to be happening more frequently, I suspect.
That's right, and I've been watching the foster care system over the last 15 years and realising that there's not many people who actually want to take on kids who've got a lot of problems, and the gay and lesbian community have actually saved that system. So it's been good enough for us to allow that community to take on problems that we didn't want to own. So I think it's more than good enough for us to say that if you're prepared to sacrifice, you're prepared to love them, you're prepared to support them, then why wouldn't you be considered an equal parent?
I wonder how big an issue it is, I suppose, in adoption, only that I did read a figure somewhere where there are only about 15 adoptions a year in New South Wales. So are there many adoptions actually proceeding?
Look, it costs a lot of money to try and achieve that. So I knew of someone who had been fostering this child and had been very, very successful, and they'd had him for many years and he was really doing extremely well compared to his past life, which was very traumatic, and they wanted to move, and so they then started adoption procedures so that they could move overseas for a period of time. But, you know, it costs a lot of money to do that. You've got to be in a situation where you can handle the stress and the ongoing litigation, etc. So, look, it doesn't happen very often, but I suppose they're saying we want the right to.
So I suppose it's probably mostly in the situation where the child's been fostered, and then the foster parents then want to proceed from there to adoption, that this sort of legislation is going to have some impact.
Well, it's about the child's biological or original parents not wanting to take on that responsibility.
Yes.
So they certainly are not stealing children from parents who are committed and want them. No.
No. And what's on the agenda at the conference in, was it 18, 19 September?
Yeah, that's right. We're having it at the Richmond Town Hall. Yes. And so we're covering things like, what are the big issues? What's it like for kids in schools these days? How do you handle society's attitudes and help your kids develop resilience? Understanding physical health in kids under 5, because being a gay dad, you know, there's a few with teenagers, but there's a huge amount with little children and babies. So we're trying to meet all of those needs, and we've got experts from La Trobe Uni, from Drummond Street in terms of family issues, we've got maternal child health nurses, etc. involved, and we've got a great guest speaker who's very well known, and he comes from Tasmania where he's a gay activist, and his name's Rodney Croom, and he's going to talk about progressing the rights of gay dads. We've got a bit of comedy in there from some comedians who are going to run a gay dad's quiz. And we've also got legal issues for dads. We've got 3 different types of sessions so that people know their rights and what they're getting into. And a lot on parenting. So it's going to be varied and a lot of fun and a chance to network as well. And it goes for 1.5 days, yeah, in about 2 weeks. So we're still taking bookings. We've got a few places left on 9639-2576, and we've kept it very affordable. It's $45 per person or per family. So if you want to come with your partner, you can do that.
It sounds very reasonable for a conference. And the conference runs from 9:30 Saturday until 4:30 Saturday afternoon, and then it's on again on Sunday, I believe.
That's right. And it finishes at lunchtime with a picnic in the park. And we couldn't have done it without Berry Family Law and Auschild. They've been our major sponsors. And so we really thank them for getting it off the ground for us.
So this is the first one. Are you planning to make this an annual event?
Well, we've had so much interest, I think it has to be. But I like actually running conferences every 2 years so that I don't have a nervous breakdown every year. But, yeah, there's definitely a call for it. And so many people have phoned me and said, can I be involved? I've had, you know, more offers than I've had spots to put them in terms of speakers and facilitators. So I'm really pleased with that.
Yes, it's well, it's and I imagine, are there any interstate people coming to the conference?
Yes, there is. So we've got quite a few from Sydney and a couple from Adelaide and some from Tassie and one from Queensland so far.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, it's $45 per person or per family.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's a very cheap conference, and it sounds like people are going to get a lot of useful information from it, as well as a bit of fun.
Yeah, that's right. And I want them to leave fully informed, knowing all the ups and downs, but feeling really optimistic.
Yes, well, as I say, the focus is on the children, but really, you know, if you've got happy dads, it'll help to have happy children as well, won't it?
Absolutely. When we look after ourselves and our relationships, it just radiates to the kids usually, so that's the way to think about it.
Mm. And, well, we were talking earlier about the general trauma following a breakup of a marriage, and I think if it's a dad who's previously been straight decides he's now gay, it's you've added another set of complicating factors,
yeah,
haven't you?
Yeah, you can imagine the response from the in-laws, and, you know, it's a really difficult situation to be in. And yet, having said that, as the years go past, when people's hearts are in the right place, somehow they're able to work it out. So don't lose hope.
Yes, actually, I knew someone who was a dad and decided he was going to be a transsexual and was turning into a woman. That posed another set of problems. How do you explain that to the child?
Yeah, that's right.
It's a very diverse community, isn't it, we live in?
We are, but, you know, I see people who are in their 20s and 30s who are talking about their childhood, and I hear all sorts of stories about all different things that have happened, and generally they'll say, but he was always there for me. He never let me down. He was always honest with me. He was always kind and caring. And that overshadows any of the complications, whereas I've known many people in very normal families, but the love and the commitment isn't there, and the kids are damaged all their life. So I want people to focus on, there's so much you can do to manage the ups and downs of family life.
Yes. I think we're getting to the stage where you wonder what is normal these days, don't you? But,
well, that's a good thing. Let's chuck out normal and just go with healthy.
Yeah. Well, look, on that note, we might have to end it there, Helen, but thank you very much for coming on the program. It's Helen Remington from the Drummond Street Services. And, Helen, I wonder if you could just tell us one more time how to get in contact with Drummond Street Services.
Absolutely. The number is 9639 2576, and just ask for Zoe.
Great, and there's a website?
Yes, www.dsfordrummondstreet.org.au.
That's great. All right, Helen, thank you once again for coming on the program, and we wish you all the very best for Drummond Street Services and for your conference that's coming up, and thank you for all the great work you're doing in the community.
Terrific. Thanks, Bill.
Thanks, Helen.
Bye.
Daddy's not home.
Of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you were ever there anyway.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437. or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Welcome back to Dads on the Air this 7th day of September 2010. And our next guest is Bettina Arndt, a well-known author and commentator. Bettina trained as a clinical psychologist before becoming a sex therapist and social commentator. She was the editor of the influential Forum magazine and spent 10 years talking about sex on television and radio. She then moved to writing about broader social issues, working as a columnist and feature writer for leading newspaper articles, and she is the best-selling author of Private Lies, All About Us, Taking Sides, The Sex Diaries, and most recently, What Men Want in Bed. Are you there, Tina?
I am, Bill.
Well, after that introduction, I wonder...
it's actually, the new book is called What Men Want. The in-bed's a little subtitle.
Oh, okay.
We thought it was a bit less embarrassing for men to ask for what a book called What Men Want.
Well, the first question, I suppose, is I'm asking who it's addressed to, because do men not know what they want, or is it addressed to them as well?
Oh, it's definitely addressed to them as well. Because I think they rarely talk to each other about what they want. So some of this may come as a revelation to them, and some of it may come as a comfort to discover other men think as they do. It is really very much inspired by the fact that men are often pretty bad about talking about their intimate lives with each other or even with their partners. And so I was keen to give them a chance to do that.
And how did you tease it out of them? Did you find they found it easier to write than to speak about it?
Oh, I think so, yes. And look, I just went and got volunteers and ended up with 150 men writing for me, and some of them kept diaries for up to a year, and some of them just, you know, wrote occasional bits and pieces to me, answered questionnaires, that sort of thing. So it was a real mixture, and they were very open with me.
Yes.
And a lot of them really loved it, I think, because they often said that they never talked about this sort of stuff before. And they valued the opportunity to talk about it, particularly in a positive way. I mean, I'm very conscious of the fact that sexuality has become something that... male sexuality is something that's often talked about only in negative terms. You know, men are always in trouble with over, you know, not being able to keep their trousers zipped, or looking at women in the wrong way, or you name it. Sexuality tends to be something that's sort of a negative thing.
Yes.
And I just thought it'd be really nice to celebrate this really wonderful life force that is men, you know, the centre of many men's lives, and yet they're never allowed to discuss it in a positive way.
Yes. Now, I think your father... he's a European, or he was born in
Germany.
Mm-hmm. Have you found any difference between the attitude in Australia and, say, in Europe?
Oh, well, I didn't grow up in Europe. I mean, he and my mother met in England, actually. So the European background was there, but it wasn't really much my experience. I have never lived in Europe. I've only lived in America.
I know you spent some years in Manhattan. Did you notice a difference between American men and Australian men?
Not particularly. I married one of them. No. I mean, I don't know, some sort of subtle differences, but nothing you'd really... I think a lot of men are pretty similar in most respects. Mm.
Yes, and what were some of your conclusions from the study of these 150 men?
Well, a whole range of issues I talk about. I talk about, you know, this drive for sexual variety and how that gets a lot of men into trouble, and why it is that we see these famous men being caught with their pants down, and what's that all about. I talk about issues like men are 20 times more likely than women to have an unusual sexual interest. I had some amazing stories there with... for instance, a couple of men being attracted to women's knickers, and one man wearing his wife's knickers under his bowls shorts, which I thought was pretty interesting. Men who have sexual experiences with other men who are totally heterosexual, and yet turn to other men for the sort of sex that they can't get at home. So there was all that sort of rich experience. One of the big battlegrounds between men and women at the moment is pornography. And I had men explaining why they're interested in pornography, because, of course, all we ever hear is the really negative aspects of the internet porn. But I had a lot of my men writing about the fact that they turn to it when they are sexually frustrated very often, because you know, a lot of them are in situations where they get not nearly as much sex as they'd like in their relationship, and so they use the pornography to keep a lid on their frustrations. But fascinating stuff, because I had often their partners writing as well, so I was able to look at both sides of that story, because women often have a lot of trouble understanding why it is that men are interested in pornography. Mm. And there's a big gap between the erotica that many women enjoy and what men, you know, the sort of material men might want to look at. I think the person who summed that up rather nicely was Isabel Allende, who once said, "Erotica is like using a feather, pornography the whole chicken." And I was interested in why men need the whole chicken, and they explained that beautifully, I think. So those sort of issues. But the heart of the book is all about erections. I have five chapters on erections, because this to me was really, I really wanted to do the whole book on erections, and my publisher wouldn't let me. But I mean, we live an extraordinary time, because for the first time ever, we have wonderful new treatments for erection problems. And every second man over 50 is struggling with this. 20,000 a year with prostate cancer, most of whom are going to go at least for a period with erectile dysfunction. And we know nothing about that. And to give men a chance to talk about what that's like, how they react, what's it like to pop a little blue pill, or what do the different treatments feel like, what's it like to use the injection therapy, or to have an implant, all those sort of things, and to talk about how their wives are reacting to it all. And so I've just got fantastic material on what is a real new era for men, I think.
And are the men taking these treatments because for their own enjoyment, or is it they feel they have a duty for their wife, or what's the main driver?
I think mainly for their own enjoyment. I think it's a really devastating thing for a man to lose the capacity to get an erection. Not all men, but most men really struggle with that. And they wrote so eloquently for me about what it's like not to get erections anymore. I no longer feel like a man, you know, one man said, with a piece of marshmallow between my legs. Mm. I've lost my best friend, said another, even if he was a dickhead. That was sweet. But, I mean, so I had lovely, lovely material from men about that whole experience and what that's like. Terrible stories. One man talking about the fact that when he started to not get erections anymore, he couldn't talk to his wife about it, because they never really talked about sex. And, you know, they'd just done it. It had all worked well. And all of a sudden he had this problem. And he was staying up later and later watching television, just in a panic about what to do, because he'd always tended to have this set pattern of going from foreplay to intercourse, and without the capacity to get erections, he was just sort of flummoxed. And he'd stay up later and later and watching television. His wife just didn't know what on earth was going on, why he wasn't coming near her anymore. And eventually she was so miserable, she moved into the other room, and they eventually got a divorce. And he wrote to me last year saying that he just read my book, The Sex Diaries, and he said he cried and cried, realizing he'd let his whole marriage slip away because he couldn't talk about sex. Mm. So I've just got some amazing stories and wonderful stories of couples who are working their way through some of the problems, particularly for the older men. So it's pretty exciting stuff, I think. Brand new. This is from the coal face of the Viagra revolution.
Yes, well, Tina, Ian Purdy here, sorry to interrupt, but it's pretty well known that Salvador Dali had erectile dysfunction problems, and all of those kind of droopy things in his paintings are supposed to be alluding to the fact that he couldn't get it up, for want of better terminology, and it pretty much infiltrated all of his art.
Yeah. Look, I mean, it's just something men so rarely talk about, and yet, I mean, when they give it a chance to discuss it, they really enjoyed having, you know, that sort of information. And I think I'm so pleased that I can now provide men with really helpful detail, very detailed. It's more than you ever want to know about erections.
Yeah, well, somebody on this program a couple of weeks ago said it's easy to fake an orgasm, it's impossible to fake an erection.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I mean, but of course, you don't need an erection to make love. And I've got men, I've got a wonderful man, for instance, who's totally unfazed by the fact his erection's a bit capricious and it comes and goes. And he's got a wonderful, demanding partner who likes a second or third session occasionally. And he just carries on. And, you know, if he doesn't get erect, he just sort of stuffs it in, and it might get erected or doesn't. And it just this lovely, joyous attitude to it, which I think will be very inspiring to other men, to see that you don't necessarily need to have, you know, a firm erection to enjoy lovemaking, and there are ways you could do that. Now, I've included some very explicit, detailed material from men's diaries showing how they do that, because I think that's really important.
And Tara, does this link with your other book, the Sex Diaries?
Oh, absolutely, because, I mean, I suppose if you, the book, you know, of course, this book is called What Men Want, and what men really want is more sex. I mean, that was the big theme that came out, which is, of course, very much what I talked about in the Sex Diaries, was this imbalance of the desire and how frustrated many men are at living with sexual needs. And also, but it's not about sexual frustration, but about the how degrading men find it to be constantly rejected, and how difficult it is to, you know, live with a relationship where you're having sex doled out occasionally, like meaty bites to a dog, and you're always having to grovel for it. Now, fascinating. One of the things I wanted to also do in terms of following up the Sex Diaries was to look at, to try to get men who have low drive, who are relatively rare, but they certainly exist. And I deliberately recruited some of them to come and to write for me, and they're really fascinating, talking about what it's like to live with a low drive all their life. Or else, in that group, there were some men who had been very interested in sex, but sort of went off it because they got fed up with having to always, grovel for sex, and it just became too humiliating for them. So they're very interesting too.
Yes, I can imagine if the man's gone to the trouble of popping blue pills or injecting himself or doing all this, and then finds she's not interested anyway.
Oh, I know. That's fascinating. Because these new treatments sometimes have a little period before they kick in. You know, Viagra, you often have an hour. And men, you know, taking a little pill and then...
No, more than an hour, Bettina, I can tell you from experience.
It varies.
Longer than an hour.
And then...
Allow, you know, five or six.
If you're then trying to... you know, you've got her all hot to trot, and you've been working on her all day to get her in the mood, and then you take the pill thinking everything's good, and then, you know, by the time you get in there, she's fast asleep. I mean, men are really complaining about the sort of juggling act they have to do there, and that's difficult. I was very interested in women's reaction to all of this, and some of the women were intriguing to me in their absolute rejection of this as an artificial, just a process, using these erection drugs. And I wonder whether they would, would they feel the same if he was given, or had to have a pacemaker? Mm. I mean, it seems at some level to be a bit of an excuse from some women, this idea that they don't want their partner to take something unnatural.
Yes,
but it's all very fascinating.
After your last book, there was a bit of controversy, I think, with some of your sisters arguing that you were suggesting that women were being forced into doing things they didn't want to do, which mm-hmm. I think you disagreed with. But I wonder if you could tell us a bit about that, and also if you're expecting any similar sort of reaction with this book.
Yes, what I was talking about was this notion of just do it, and the idea that, you know, I think there is a basic problem if you're in an intimate relationship, if you're in a marriage, for instance, and you've totally shut up shop and you're refusing to have sex, and yet you expect your partner to be faithful to you. I think that's a very big ask. And amazingly, a lot of men still do it. I had one man in my new book who went for 19 years with no sex. His wife totally refused to have sex after their last child was born. And he, you know, tried desperately to persuade her and to seduce her, and then eventually, in the end, couldn't bear it. He was only in his 40s, and he left the marriage. And she just couldn't believe he'd left the marriage for the sake of sex. Mm. But it was all about what it's like to live with that constant rejection and how it made him feel. The point I've always made is the whole notion of just do it isn't about... lying back and think of England and putting up with something you don't want to do. It's about exploring the possibility that you might, from women's point of view, exploring the possibility that you might enjoy arousal and pleasure, even if you didn't feel like sex to start off with. And we now know that there's been new research showing that many women can enjoy sex without desire, but they have to get their head in the right place. But similarly, I also say that men too must just do it. And I have men in the new book talking about, you know, the whole business of, for instance, when you when men have erectile dysfunction, they often go into a panic and would rather avoid sex altogether than try it and fail. But they too are leaving their partners stranded there. And I have many women talking about the fact that that makes them feel incredibly unwanted when that happens to them. So I'm saying those men must just do it. They can't leave their partner feeling that they're totally undesirable. So it works both ways. I think I don't think this. Obviously, that's not as controversial. I think some people, women, probably won't like this book because it's focusing on men and it's celebrating male sexuality. And as I said, we got a bit used to seeing male sexuality in only negative terms. And I think there'll be some people who are determined to continue to see these things this way and will find my approach rather offensive. But I don't think that will apply to men.
So, generally speaking, would you encourage the men in this situation to perhaps read pornography, or is that something you'd encourage?
I don't encourage, but that's exactly what men are doing. That's one of the ways they cope with their situation. And I don't think it's... I mean, look, there can be problems with pornography, but I think most of the time it's harmless and it's serving a useful purpose. You know, the whole notion that it, you know, changes your brain chemistry and all of that, I think is rubbish. You know, that's a very controversial area, and I think that's where, in fact, some people won't like what I said. But I wanted to give men a chance to explain themselves on that issue.
Yes, because it must be, in a community, it must be very common. If you read that pornography is the most used area of the internet, so there must be a lot of people out there using it, and I suspect they're mainly men.
Oh, they are mainly men. Look, there's some couples who look at it together. There's some women who are very accepting of it. But a lot of women find it very threatening. You know, they can't believe that if he's looking at a man, you know, lots of women with lovely big boobs, that they, you know, that doesn't mean that he is critical of them. I mean, women tend to see it all as sort of front and an attack on the way they look and feel, rather than seeing this as just something separate from the man's feelings for their partner. I have a lovely chapter on nudity where I have women talking about how they feel about their bodies and the fact that many of them are still so self-conscious about being naked with their men. And the men talking beautifully about how they love to look at the women, and men, you know, men in their 80s describing their partners and how beautiful she looks, and they're not looking at the saggy bits and the bumps and the lumps and the cellulite. They still see her as gorgeous, and how the difficulty they have at convincing women of that, and the frustration they feel that they're so rarely allowed to look at and revel in their partner's bodies. So, you know, all these issues are tied up together in women's insecurities and men struggle to convince women. You know, the men are just so wonderful in the way they talk about their partners and their love for their partners and their admiration for her. And the trouble is we tend not to believe that. And we're often threatened when he looks at another woman or looks at a sexy picture of another woman. So it's a lot of it is about women's insecurities, I think.
It also goes the other way with men. I mean, if you watch porno, I mean, the size of those men's penises and those things is daunting.
Well, it's artificial. And this is a sort of fantasy world. The feminists tend to complain that the sort of thing you see in pornography is nothing like real sex. Of course it's not. Real sex can be very hard work. You know, hours of foreplay.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's right.
And all the effort that goes into getting it started.
Yeah, this is about fantasy. Just as women, you know, chick lick letters about women's fantasies. The bodice-ripping novels that a lot of women like are about men who behave in a totally unreal way. And no one ever, you know, fights over the laundry in those sort of books.
Well, that's female pornography, isn't it? Because women are stimulated by words, whereas men are stimulated by what they see.
Absolutely.
So it really does. I mean, women reading like those Mills and Boons and all that soft, you know, schmaltzy stuff. I mean, that's female pornography. That's how women get off.
And that's just as unrealistic and just as arguably, you know,
ridiculous.
Teaching women the wrong view of relationships as the pornography is.
Yep.
But that's what it's supposed to be about, fantasy. It's supposed to be about something different from real life. And, I mean, it's just that the whole debate on relationships is conducted by women. And women's view holds forth, and it's pretty rare that men get a chance to get a word in. And it's pretty rare that men are able to voice their own, you know, feelings and emotions on these issues. Men do a lousy job advocating for themselves. I mean, one of the other areas I talk about, for instance, in the prostate cancer area is the fact that we have this peculiar situation where men needing erectile dysfunction treatments after prostate cancer surgery, for instance, are getting no government support for that. And how is that possible when we have reasonable support? I mean, not brilliant, but, you know, women have managed to achieve quite good government support for breast reconstruction after mastectomy and breast prostheses and so on. Why is a breast worth so much more than a penis? And yet, of course, the problem is that men aren't marching in the streets for the right to an erection. But they should be. And the other day I talked to the National Press Club about this, and we have now the Urology Society of Australia and New Zealand plus the Prostate Cancer Foundation all coming together to start a campaign to look at this whole issue of inequitable treatment of cancer victims. So that's one of the areas where men need to speak out more, I think.
Yes, one of the many areas. And we're speaking with Bettina Arndt, the author of a new book, What Men Want, released on the 1st of September. And, Tina, how far would you go in encouraging men to keep this interest? I mean, would there ever be a situation where a man might be encouraged to go to a prostitute even?
Yeah, I mean, I talk to a lot of men about, you know, how do they cope? How do they cope, assuming the men are in relationships where they're, you know, somewhat deprived sexually. And most men don't want to go to prostitutes. Some do. And the ones who do, I mean, they have varying attitudes toward it, saying that's not what they want. They much prefer to make love to their wives. But it's the way they cope. That was the sort of general reaction. It's the way I deal with my situation. I had a lovely woman wrote for me, who is a woman in her 60s, who says, you know, it's wives who keep women like me in business. She was a sex worker. And she talked at length about the men who come to her who aren't getting any sex in their relationships. I mean, women find it, there's just such a gulf between male and female sexuality in terms of the nature of the drive, I think. And, you know, men talking about the fact that the itch never goes away. Now, I had men in their 80s writing for me about still being driven by sex. I had an interesting man wrote to me and he said, I don't think I can take part in your research because I'm a virgin. And he was 71. But he never actually had a relationship with a woman. He wanted to get married and he just never found the right woman. And so it just sort of slipped by him in a way. But he struggled all his life with his strong drive, and he now is using medication because he can't cope with the sort of fact that that itch is always there. So it's a fascinating thing. And women, I mean, not saying that women don't enjoy sex, but many women have periods of their lives when they're terribly into sex. But it's pretty rare to have a woman where sex is center stage all their lives. And that's true of many men.
Yes, well, Tina, look, I can say that as a man and in this program, we're very glad to have you as a champion for men's issues. I'm just wondering, you know, with your background as a clinical psychologist, I've always wondered how you first got into this area.
Oh, it was sort of largely accidental. I was being trained at the University of New South Wales by a man who, one of our teachers who happened to be a man who was very interested in sex therapy, and the new Masters and Johnson research had just been published, and he said he wanted to try out the new techniques that Masters and Johnson had developed for sexual problems. And so because he indicated that we were willing to see people with these problems at our clinic, we were just swamped with people with sexual problems and had a lovely time. You know, I thought it was a wonderful area to work in.
Yes.
Particularly then. I mean, it was easy then in a way because a lot of people just wanted someone to talk to, wanted a bit of information. It's all become rather more complicated.
Yes. Yeah. And, well, and then you, over the years you've had men's issues and you've gone into more general social issues, and now you're back on the
men's
issues.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the time I was doing the work on social issues, I was championing men. As you know, I did a lot of work on men and divorce. But it all happened because I started working with women, and that's how I got involved in the whole sex field. But men then started to talk to me, and they started to talk to me about their relationships. And, of course, one of the issues that really emerged strongly was the fact that they were heartbroken, that many men after divorce, that having lost contact with their children, and I got very involved with that and ended up on various government committees trying to bring in some reforms to ensure children's rights to having a father in their lives. So it's been a sort of bit of a journey, really. But I'm very pleased to be back with sex. It's actually much more fun than the rest of the stuff.
Well, we know with those government committees, the other controversial area you've been involved in was your criticism of our current acting Prime Minister, Julia. I was just wondering what you must be a defender of marriage. Is that why you looked at Julia in the way you did?
No, look, I'm not. Yes, I've spent a lot of flack over that one. I was talking about this interesting situation of having a Prime Minister in a de facto relationship. And because I've lived in de facto relationships, and I would again. It's not an issue at all for me, of course. This notion that I've become such a conservative old stick is a bit of a worry, really.
Yes, it was a bit of a surprise.
But there are issues, and I've never been one to hold back from talking about something. And one of the issues that I'm sure we all know women in this situation, is there's a problem for women with de facto relationships, particularly women who want to have children and spend long time living with someone in their 30s, for instance, and never really sorting out at the start of the relationship whether it's a serious relationship for the man. And that's really quite a common... The problem is that de facto relationships start off on a different basis. When you're getting married, most people surely, ask the big questions. Is this going to be the sort of... are we hoping this will be a permanent relationship? Do we want children? They at least talk about the big issues when they're getting married, whereas a lot of people end up living with each other because someone's lease runs out or because you get sick of rushing home for clean underpants. It can be a very casual start to a relationship. And there's really solid research on this from the Institute of Family Studies that shows that the expectations in those relationships can be very different, where one person sees it as a permanent thing and the other doesn't, yet they never talk about it, or they don't talk about it until well into the relationship. And so a woman can very easily find herself after a couple of years living with a man who turns out not to be interested in making it permanent, not be interested in having children. And she can then be, find herself at age 38 or 40 having missed out. And I think that's a real issue. Not for everybody, and only obviously for women who want to have children, but for those women. And I've had lots of letters from people agreeing with me about that. And the other issue I talk about is the fact that I am very concerned about relationships is the impact on children of divorce. And in terms of, we know, there's just no question that de facto relationships are less stable than marriages for all the sort of reasons I've been talking about. And we had hoped, I suppose, that people who have children in de facto relationships are going to be more likely to stay together than if they hadn't had those children, and the evidence is that that's not the case. And that's a problem. Mm. It's not in children's interest to be born into relationships that are going to be break up.
No.
Marriages break up at a high enough a rate. We don't need any more children to have to go through that than are happening already. Mm. So the trend for more children to be born into de facto relationships is not a good thing for those children. And we need to talk about that. And I don't care less. The flack I got over that article just drove me crazy. People wrote to me and said, stick your head in the oven, you old bag, what, can't we have reasonable discussion? These are real issues. And I find it appalling that there's this climate in which people get howled down if they discuss things that, somehow people feel impinge on their own lives. Too bad, luckily we live in a democracy where we can discuss these things. We're not run by people who think they have a right to shut other people up just because they're discussing things they don't like.
Yes, it's extraordinary, isn't it? Because as a Prime Minister, you really open yourself up to comment and people having opinions about what you do and your lifestyle and everything else. So,
it's an interesting issue because, that's what a lot of people wrote to me. Does Julia moving into the lodge with her mate have any influence? Why on earth should you think we're stupid enough to follow her example? Well, we talk about, for instance, a footballer who behaves badly off the field, you know, as they do. And we talk about the impact on young boys of that, and we're very worried about that. Why wouldn't we be worried about whether a very popular prime minister might influence women into not thinking carefully about these issues? I mean, surely there is some argument there.
Yes, I mean, and yes, and is the argument that to be successful, you can't have a family or, you know, husband and children? It's,
well, I'd never say that. And I think, you know, the point I made when I wrote about this is it's great for Julia. Why shouldn't she live with him? A woman in her 50s who doesn't want children, I think it's a perfect, you know, it seems very odd to want to get married then at some level. Because I think marriage is essentially about protecting children.
Yes.
So it's not a bit, of course it's not an issue for her, and apparently she never was very interested in having kids, so that's fine. But it's not fine for everybody, and I think we need to talk about that.
Yes. We're speaking with Bettina Arndt, the author of a new book, What Men Want. Bettina, I think we're getting towards the end of our time, but I was wondering if there's anything else you'd like to draw our attention to in the new book.
Oh, I think, there's a whole lot of other stuff. I mean, I worked really hard pulling together a lot of the latest research and medical information to help men. I mean, for instance, there's wonderful new information out about premature ejaculation and the fact that we now know that there is a group of men who have a sort of lifetime problem with premature ejaculation. Most men learn to control ejaculation naturally, if you like, or through experience, and some men never do. And it turns out that they have it's in their genes. That we've actually identified the gene that controls ejaculation, and there are men who are just trigger happy. They're just made that way. And it's funny, it runs in the family. If you're like that, you probably have an uncle or a brother or something. Not that men ever talk
about.
Well,
you'd never be able to find out, would you? You wouldn't ask the question.
And there's a brand new drug about to come out for men with that problem, which is going to be like Viagra. You can take it on demand, and you will, you know, an hour or so later have a bit more control over ejaculation. So that's fantastic news for men. So, I mean, lots of really exciting stuff in there. And I think what the important message I want to give in relation to both premature ejaculation and erectile dysfunction is you need to go to your doctor. Don't go near those ghastly clinics who are ripping men off. It just makes me so mad.
I've had the nose spray people.
Nasal spray that doesn't work. Mm. And men are conned into paying thousands of dollars for this stuff. And it makes me just furious when we have good treatments now available that actually work. You just have to have the courage to go to your GP, guys. Do it.
Well, as a first step, I'd recommend you buy the book, What Men Want. It's got a recommended retail price of $34.99.
And if the booksellers don't have them, ask them why not, because some of the bookshops are being really slack about ordering it.
Okay, so make sure you do that. And then as a secondary advice, you might consider going to your doctor.
Yeah, and if people want to contact me, my website actually has a great forum where men and women have been discussing all these issues, which is worth looking at. But also you can contact me through that.
So what's your website, Tina?
www.bettinaarndt.com.au.
Okay. So
and also I'd love to come out and talk to groups about these sort of issues. So if anyone's looking for a speaker, here I am.
Great. Well, look, Tina, as always, it's a delight talking to you. Thank you very much for coming on the show.
Nice to talk to you, Bill.
And wish you all the best with the new book.
Thanks very much.
Okay, thanks again.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Going up and down all around the bay. You could have a bumper car bumping. This amusement never ends. I wanna be the sledgehammer. Why don't you call my name? Oh, let me be your sledgehammer.
Dan's in Distress, meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dan's in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dad's on the Air.
It's Dad's on the Air for 7 September 2010. Looks like we've run out of time again, so we'd like to especially thank our guests today. We had Helen Remington from the Drummond Street Services and well-known author and commentator Bettina Arndt speaking about her new book, What Men Want. So we'd like to thank our guests. We've got another big show lined up next week. And in the meantime, you can download this program. You can listen to it again on www.dadsontheair.net. And if you stay tuned now, you'll get to hear Country Bob on Country On. So until next week, this is Bill Cable and
Ian Purdy,
and we'll see you all next week.
We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're dads.